About 6 months ago, the journalist Diana Nyad returned to making sports news rather than just writing about it. She went back to the pursuit of her youth, long-distance swimming. She set her mind to a swim that she'd failed to complete 30 years earlier, one from Cuba to Florida. Although she's now over 60, she says she's in great shape and that she could have made it if she hadn't run into the jellyfish. This past September, she was pulled from the water with welts across her shoulders and arms, and she looked pretty beaten up, too.
Yeah, you can't help it that your face, you know, is going to be swollen with the saltwater exposure. Your lips are big and fat and swollen with that. And the jellyfish venom, you know, definitely affected my inner being, my system. And don't forget, I had a series of meds given to me, from epinephrine to Xanax to, prednisone to, you know, all. They threw the kitchen sink into my body, and I think that kind of racked me, too.
Diana is now back in the water, practicing for one more run at that Cuba to Florida swim. For her, it's still about finishing something that she started a long time ago. But she's also determined to make a statement about who she is today. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
Support for The Story comes from the Redwoods Group Foundation, collaborating with Darkness to Light and local YMCAs to prevent child sexual abuse in America. D2L.org.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It is co-produced by APM, American Public Media.
Coming up later this hour, an historic pause in another endless pursuit. The people who paint the great steel rail bridge across Scotland's Firth of Forth take their first real break in 120 years. First, though, to the swimmer who won't quit. Diana Nyad spent the majority of her 20s in the water, moving from one long-distance swimming competition to the next. Her first was in Lake Ontario.
At the end of that swim, 27 hours, 38 minutes in Lake Ontario, which got down into the low 50s, the water temperature that day is just, you know, whoo. And I was, at a low body core temperature when I finished, so I was taken to the hospital. I'm in the hospital, and they had wrapped me in a Mylar blanket and set me in a corner where my people went off to, you know, file insurance and get somebody to look after me. And I was just sitting there, you know, kind of shivering like this. And a guy was rolled in on a gurney, and he was in pain. He was wincing and grimacing and screaming out, and he was parked right next to me. Our heads were, like, virtually next to each other. And his people ran off to get him checked in and get somebody to take care of him. And I think just to take his mind off his pain, he screeched out. He said, why are you in here? What's wrong with you? And I was shivering, and I said, I just swam across Lake Ontario. And he took a beat, and he said, why the hell did you do that? And we got talking. It turned out he was in a cigarette boat accident on Lake Ontario that day. He was going 140 miles an hour. His boat hit a wave. He flipped. And evidently, he was telling me his people are pretty sure he's got a broken pelvis. He's definitely got a broken collarbone, broken cheekbone. You could see the fracture actually, you know, compounded out of the skin. He was in bad shape. And we just got talking, even through his pain and my discomfort. And it really got around to the subject of why. Why would he do something so life-threatening? And he told me that he was just impassioned, in love with the feeling of adrenaline rush, that his hands on that wheel going that fast, knowing that any little turn could be the end of his life. It thrilled him. And I started to tell him, well, you know what? This was my first day out. But there was something about kind of the metaphor of the sport of stroke after stroke. You come upon obstacles. You don't feel well. You're cold. You're not even halfway. There was something about it that reminded me of life itself, is that you want to get to the other end. You want to be your best self. You don't want to give up. You never want to give up. And I didn't enjoy feeling cold all day. I didn't enjoy a lot of the discomfort of it, but I loved getting to that other shore and knowing that I didn't give up when many others did. So honestly, that's what gripped me about it right from the beginning.
And after that, then, Diana, what kept you coming back? You did the swim around Manhattan. You set a world record swimming from the Bahamas to Florida. Was it, I just wanted to go further? I want to be the best, or was it something more internal, more personal?
Well, you know, those two swims that you mentioned, you know, were solo swims. I did them by myself, and they were, you know, at the time, they were, you know, sort of big news. Manhattan Island certainly was, and then the Bahamas years later was. But, you know, I actually joined the sport. Many people don't know it because it's a minor, eccentric sport. And you can go to Egypt, and people swim down the Nile, and you can go to Argentina, and people swim in February, these long races in the oceans and rivers and lakes down there. And you can go up to Canada in the summer, and you can go around the world. And the United States, not so much. Back in the day, you know, I'm trying to think, pre-World War II, in the 20s and 30s, there were some famous swims in Lake Michigan and Atlantic City. But
right. And
by
the
time
Channel
I got
has involved, always been up there as a
oh,
place.
Yeah, the English Channel, which is a little bit passé now. But, you know, you can imagine
not
the
long
well, you know, it's not just that. It's just the imagination of it. It's like you can imagine 100 years ago, you know, the great history of the continent of Europe, you know, across from the British Isles. That was something that, you know, people, I mean, Charlemagne, you know, crossed the English Channel. So that was the big deal about it. And that's what Cuba is for me. You know, there are many people say to me, well, if the jellyfish are so dangerous, if the weather is so darn hard to predict, go do some other 103-mile swim somewhere. And I say it has nothing to do with the distance. I could care less how far it is across. I want to swim between these two countries. There isn't a more, you know, there isn't a more famous body of water that sparks the imagination like that stretch between Cuba and Florida. But anyway, back in the day, I actually, it wasn't just Manhattan and the Bahamas, and it wasn't just to be, you know, do better. I was swimming against people. I was going to Argentina and Egypt and Canada and all these places and standing on a shore with 400, 500 guys, right, mostly men, and a gun would go off and we'd all scramble and hit each other in elbows and swear in Arabic. And we'd get a little, you know, swatch of free water when we got next to our boats and see who could get to the other side first and win a little bit of prize money. So it's a real sport, you know, competitive sport.
And after the Bahamas swim, you took a long break, right?
Yeah, I did. 30 years. That swim was August 1979. And, you know, yes, Cuba was, it broke my heart not to make it from Cuba to Florida. But, after I failed in 1978, went 42 hours, huge, huge waves.
This was the swim, you know, in the shark cage, right?
Yep, okay. It was in the cage for the most part. I got out a few times. But, you know, it did break my heart, you know, not to finish that swim and not to have it, you know, in my memory bank. But once I did the Bahamas swim, I was offered a job by the Wide World of Sports. I just turned 30. And my friend said, you know, when are you ever going to grow up and have a job and, you know, look toward the future? And I thought, yep, now's the time. And so I wasn't really suffering. Like, if you and I had been friends over that 30 years from 79 to 09, a couple of years ago, I wouldn't have been saying, Dick, to you, you know, every time we got together, oh, Dick, I just wake up in cold sweats at night. Cuba's in my dreams. But when I decided to do it, turning 60, it turns out it was in the back pocket of the mind somewhere.
You know? How much of this had to do with turning 60?
A lot. I never had a problem with age. You know, a lot of people, when you talk to them when they're 90, they say, you know, when was the first time you, and people say, oh, 50. 50 was a big, 50 was no big deal to me. You live life every day. You get a little older, you look in the mirror and you got some wrinkles you didn't used to have. The breasts are a little bit lower than they used to be. And I never cared about any of that. You know, I just didn't have a big angst over aging itself. But when I turned 60, I don't know. I was thwacked, you know, across the existential, you know, frontal lobe. I just, you know, was trying to rack up, you know, who had I become? And, you know, have I done with my life? And I wasn't talking about, oh, did you make it into a Hall of Fame or did you, you know, win this or that? I was just talking about just real human, you know, striving for excellence as a human being. And I just was feeling lost. My mom had died at 82. So I was thinking to myself, well, you know, what does that mean? I got 22 measly years left. What am I going to do with them? You know, and if half of that's going to be old age or Alzheimer's, like my mom had, you can't even count the whole 22. So 60 was a big part of it. As a matter of fact, I didn't even think at first I knew I wanted to do something. At 60, I thought, you know, to relieve the malaise of this, you know, feeling I've never done anything and I've never become anything. And I, you know, I want to do something and live large and feel alive and awake and alert.
Wait, time out, Diana. You're an author, published author. You're an acknowledged sports journalist. You hold world records. You are in the Hall of Fame. I mean, what did you have to prove to anybody?
You know what it is? It's deeper than that. It's not all that stuff. Yeah, I can be introduced to a speech, and when I'm sitting backstage, you say, oh, and she did this, and she won this, and God, you know, what more can you do? And I'm proud of all that. I'm not saying that. It's more that, Dick, I think a lot of people talk about this. A lot of people sit in therapist's office talking about this. I have had that little monkey chatter going on in my mind. And I just don't know how many hours I've wasted with that monkey chatter, saying to myself, you know, I'll take a 100-mile bike ride and I'll realize at the end of it that I wasn't looking at the, you know, at the horizon of the ocean, and I wasn't taking in the, you know, the flora and fauna as I went along. The whole 100 miles I've been going, why? Why didn't I do this better? Why didn't I do that better? Why? Just beating myself up. And I was sick of that monkey chatter and wasting all this, you know, positive spirit, all this terrific mind that I had. And that's why at 60, I thought, you know what? I'm going to do something that is so tough, that's so big, that's going to take so much of me, that there's not going to be room for all those regrets and why didn't you behave this way? There will not be time for that.
Diana Nyad knows that her older body has its limitations. That's why she's spending so much time training. But she's also convinced that her mind is better prepared than it ever was to lead her through that water from Cuba to Florida. I'll talk more with her in just a moment. Coming up later this hour, if you've never heard the expression painting the fourth bridge, you're about to. It's the story of a long suspension bridge north of Edinburgh, one that is subject to such savage Scottish weather that the painting crews, once they finish, start all over again. That's coming up later. I'm Dick Gordon from APM, American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. When Diana Nyad was at the peak of her career as a long-distance swimmer, she gave it up. A little over 30 years later, at the age of 60, she decided she would once again tackle the one swim that she'd never completed, from Cuba to Florida. After an exhaustive training schedule, she stepped into the water at a beach in Cuba.
I'm standing here at the prime of my life. I think this is the prime. When one reaches this age, you still have a body that's strong, but now you have a better mind. A mind at peace with the joy of the world. A mind that's full of courage and not afraid. And now I look out at a dead flat calm. So I think this is my day. And I don't know, you have to talk to me in 24 hours, and then in 48 hours, and then in 60 hours. We'll see how I feel. Yeah!
Within hours, though, there was trouble.
I swam into a big, 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 I don't know really what the plural of jellyfish is, if they're pods or schools or whatever, but a big bunch of jellyfish that precipitated a respiratory event.
Does that mean that you were unable to breathe? You had to lie on your back? You couldn't swim?
Yeah, it really debilitated me. I started, instead of stroking at 58 to 60 strokes a minute and moving forward at 2 miles an hour, stopping every 45 minutes or so for 60 seconds to get close to the boat. You're never allowed to touch the boat. Yeah. You can't get out on the boat, but you can come very close and people can, you know, hand you drinks and hand you, straw type things to suck out of. They can put a hot water hose down your bathing suit if you're cold to try to, you know, relieve that. They can treat you. They can give you injections. They can slap Vaseline on you. They can treat you and handle you. They just can't prop you up and help you float, or, you know, you can't grab on anything for, support that way. So, once I was struck, I started to swim maybe only 100 strokes instead of, you know, thousands of strokes before we get to the next break. And I was gasping. I just had no air left. I flip over on my back and, you know, just wheeze and gasp. And then when I felt like I was getting, you know, that distress under control a little bit, I'd flip back over. We had oxygen on board. The doctor had oxygen. So sometimes I'd come to the side of the boat and he'd put the mask right on my face. That doctor tried a prednisone shot, you know, which is a steroid that opens up the blood vessels. And I just didn't recuperate. And I got into, I can't remember, I think it was the 39th hour. And we just thought, you know, all these people, I wasn't dead yet, but I was close to it. And I just thought all these people involved and, you know, we're only about halfway. We had only gone about...
Do you make the call or does someone on the boat say, I want her out of the water, she's in danger?
No, I make the call. Uh-huh. I make the call. You know, even the doctors, even the people who love you a lot, they just can't make the call. You know, in boxing they do. A guy goes on the canvas, you start holding up fingers in front of his face and you feel like maybe he's approaching brain damage. They make the call, but I make the call. Unless I went unconscious and just, you know, dipped under, then of course it's over. Yeah. Other than that, it's up to me. And the same thing happened, you know, the second time out in September, except much, much worse. That was the science fiction thing I was telling you about.
So I want to ask you about this. You train 4 months to make that swim. I have no idea where a body gets the reserves to continue swimming after 10 hours, never mind 40 hours, 60 hours. It's beyond my imagination. But you turned around after the first attempt, and you were back in the water a month later trying it again. Were there people saying to you, ease up, Diana. We can do this later. You know, you don't have to push yourself so hard.
Well, people from the outside who don't know much about it, you know, yes, that was their point of view. But everybody on the inside, the 50 people who are my, you know, crew who were there the first time, they saw. I mean, literally, Dick, that swim ended. I have to get out my calendar. I think we started on August 7th. So I was swimming on August 7th and 8th. And on August 9th, we were all back in Key West and we had a big dinner, you know, 50 people and their families. So really it was about 80 people. And, you know, I, you know, talked and laughed and, you know, I had no lactic acid, you know, flowing through the muscles. I was just in such good shape that honestly, I was in the best shape I could be after that swim. It's like the August swim, we almost called a very expensive, very high profile training swim. And I was in the best shape that I had ever gotten in after that swim was over. I needed about a week to recuperate. That's it.
Wow.
And it was better to go then when the waters were still warm, give it another go, than wait like I am now having to do a whole year until, you know, the next summer.
Can I ask you about something? The 50 people.
Yeah.
I'm counting on both hands the people who are on the boat keeping you going, but how big a crew is this, and how much money does it cost to try this swim?
Well, you know, it turned out putting it together in a little bit more of a quick way the second time in September, we got it down to about 35, and it turns out that was about right. And that's what I'm going to have this summer going out. It's about 35 people. But picture just for instance, there's a shark team. These are dangerous, aggressive, quick-moving sharks. When they feel the oceanic white tip, the lemon, the tiger sharks, so it's not the great white, but just about every other species of shark swims in those waters, and this is their territory for thousands of years. From 5-6 miles away, Dick, when they hear a fish floundering on the surface, it's in trouble, it's dying, it's flapping around on the surface, 5 miles away. So other than using a cage, which I just don't want to do anymore, I've learned how much forward propulsion the cage gives you, and it's not fair. It's not kosher. So I'm going to swim out in the open elements with no cage. I've got 5 guys, and I don't mean to say they're guys like women can't do this, but my team happen to be guys. Luke Tipple he's Australian. He's probably the number one authority on sharks in the world today. And he's a conservationist. He doesn't want to kill sharks. He has no lethal weapon with him. If one were to show and, you know, show a fin, bump me a little bit for the first appearance, he would be in the water like lightning, or one of his guys would, with little PVC piping, push them away, a little bit of chum, attract them away from me. And he believes that I will not be hurt by a shark going across.
So Luke's hanging over the gunwale the whole time, day and night, or one of his team. And yeah, they're looking for like a fin, and that's enough comfort for you?
Well, even, I tell you, it was pitch black both times, especially the second time. You couldn't see your hand in front of your face, so it's not even that they're seeing things, they're hearing. But they live with these animals. They just believe they're going to know, you know, when they're there. We also have electricity, electric field emanating from a thing called the shark shield on a couple of kayaks. So it's just picture this already. I got six people in kayaks that come out two at a time to accompany me with the electric shield underneath. I got five shark guys who work two at a time, not right at the gunnels, but they're up on top of a, you know, like a bridge at the top, looking down. And so there are 11 people right there. Just the shark team is 11 people.
And you're paying them, right? These are not people who are just volunteering for each swim.
No, they're not paid. They get their expenses. Luke comes from California, so, you know, his plane fare gets paid for, but he, you know, no, he doesn't charge anything.
You pay it, right? I mean, you're the one responsible for this, aren't you?
Yeah, but I don't have that kind of money to pay people that. It's a really expenses only expedition, and it's about $300,000 when you count the boats, the entries to Cuba, the fees, the government fees, the putting up people in Key West while we're waiting, putting up people in Cuba while we're waiting. You know, that's it comes out to about $300,000, but nobody gets a salary. Nobody gets paid anything. Okay. People do this for the love of adventure. This is a big time, never done thing, and people want to be involved. So anyway, just picture 11 people already, and now we're not talking about my personal team, you know, who's taking care of me, the navigation team, the boats that have to support these people so they can go from my boat back over to the other to get a shower, get a sandwich, get a nap, and make sure they're fresh. I want the shark guys to be very fresh. When they're on the boat, I want their eyes to be rested. I want them to be extremely alert. So they're not going to work for 60, 70 hours. They need replacements. So it's easy when you can count up to 35, you can get there real easily.
Diana Nyad made her third attempt to complete the swim this past September. You're listening to The Story. That time, as well, Diana says she was filled with confidence.
I leave Cuba, it's like glass. It's just idyllic. It's almost like a watercolor painting. And I say to my best friend, my head handler, Bonnie, we're on the shore. We gave each other, you know, a little hug, and we said, this is it. The dream is about to come true. And I go busting out of there, just cruising along the surface, and I'm feeling great. And ironically, a couple of hours in, I said to myself, remember, you're not going to feel like this at the 40th hour and the 50th hour and the 60th hour. Don't, you know, this isn't all going to be, you know, a bed of roses. You better, you know, just work it hour by hour, you know. And wham! When I say science fiction, I'm not kidding. I've been stung before. You know, I've had my series of little painful things through my life. Never have I felt this. It felt like my body, the whole body, had been thrown into a vat of hot burning oil. I was on fire. So what these harpoons of the box jellyfish do is there are hundreds of thousands of harpoons along their tentacles. And when the tentacle wraps around your arm, your chest, your midsection, your thighs, and those harpoons are whipping the venom into your bloodstream. So what they were trying to do to a fish is paralyze it instantly, and they do. And I felt the paralysis. I felt it in my back and the chest. I started yelling out, fire, 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 I'm on fire. And I started swimming like a crab. I couldn't extend my arms all the way. So it's sort of like, you know, what you said before, Dick. You said, it's hard to fathom, you know, 10 hours, but, you know, 40 hours, it's hard for us mortals to fathom going that long. Well, I can fathom that because I trained for that. But this took me by surprise, by shock. So I give myself a lot of credit to have the courage to go 41 hours after being stung like that. Well, actually 39. It was 41 total. But the sting happened at the second hour. And then again on the second night, the exact same thing. So I could say, yeah, I showed a lot of courage. And my team, they rose to the occasion. They were performing like a triage unit out in the ocean with me still in the water. And we went 41 hours. So we all felt nobody can fault us for our will. That's for sure.
Yeah, no kidding.
But you know what, Dick? I don't want that. I want the athlete's experience. I want what I've trained my mind to go through. I want to be singing Neil Young songs and the Beatles. And I didn't get any of that. I was in jellyfish survival. So the trick now is to have some kind of suit of armor that I can swim in and almost be like a second skin. I don't even notice, but that those harpoons cannot penetrate. And now I can get the athlete's experience, not just the survival experience.
What about the suits?
That's the point now.
What about the suits that the Olympic swimmers are wearing now? Some of them appear to cover most of the body. Would they work?
Yep. Yeah, we're looking at those. Oddly enough, there are some of them, and you know we're testing them in aquariums. You know, we go into the aquarium of the Pacific, and we're going up to the Monterey Aquarium to literally jump in the jellyfish tanks where they have the box, the Portuguese man of war, all that. All of the weaves don't work. Sometimes it's not a matter of that the thickness of the suit, it has to do with the actual weave, almost like a pantyhose-like thing. So we haven't come upon the exact one yet, but we are testing all those Olympic suits. You're right. It's a good idea.
And what about the clock? I mean, there are a number of biological clocks, and you're facing a different one right now. You're fit. You're in great shape. But it's going to be harder and harder for you to maintain that, right, in your 60s?
Yeah, sure. It's a two-edged sword there. One is that I've spent a lifetime. I mean, there hasn't been a day. I mean, I think even days when I've had the flu, you know, I still work out that day. So I've been in just, you know, exemplary shape my whole life. So, you know, it's kind of like, look at Jack LaLanne. My God, I forget how old he was when he died last year, but the man was a rock. You know, I don't think he had sugar since 1929. And I can't pat myself on the back on that score too well. But I've taken care of this body very well. And I have a feeling that when I'm 75, I will be in very, very young, good shape, you know, athletically. So, yeah, the clock is ticking, of course. I was faster when I was a kid, but you know what? I'm actually stronger today. When I'm out in the ocean, I feel much more powerful. I don't move as fast. I can feel that. And when I'm in a pool, I can see the clock. I'm not swimming as quickly as I did when I was 25. But I don't get cold as quickly. I don't get flus as quickly. I just feel more like I said to someone at one time that I used to feel like I was a thoroughbred racehorse. I was a sleek, you know, fit athlete, and now I feel more like a Clydesdale. I'm a bigger, heavier, like I just feel like I can walk through brick walls. So in some ways, I'm kind of a better athlete for this sport, you know, even at 63. I don't want to be talking to you next year and the year after that and the year after that with you saying, Diana, I guess you tried and failed again, and you tried and failed again, and it's a big, epic journey. You can talk to Everest people, and they'll tell you that it took them 10 years going every year to make it, till they finally got it down and got all the luck together with weather and everything. I don't want to be that person. I don't want to do this for the next 10 years. One more time. Just give me one more chance and I'll make it across.
Diana Nyad is now just finishing up her pool training. She'll move to the Caribbean in a few days to resume practicing in the ocean. She says she could be ready for her next attempt to swim from Cuba to Florida sometime in July. We often hear about pride and passion in stories of people in the sporting world, but we hear it less often in reference to other professions. My next guest, Ian Heek, is a civil engineer. He's the man in charge of a grand old rail bridge across Scotland's Firth of Forth. Locals call it the Forth Bridge. In our next story, Ian talks about something as simple as a new paint job given to the bridge, one that is meant to last a long time. Now, the success of that job means that for the first time in decades, the old bridge won't be requiring so much of Ian's attention.
There's enormous pride at having done it. I mean, that's the best bit that you hang on to. But I miss it. I mean, I miss it every day. I'm very seldom on the bridge now. It's still my bridge to take care of. So hopefully I'll still be involved in that, whatever the scale of job is on the bridge. But at least I know I've been a big part of restoring it to something like what it deserves.
You see, it's more than just a job finished. It's the end of a long tradition in Scotland, the never-ending painting of the Forth Bridge. We'll talk about that next. I'm Dick Gordon from APM, American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. The Scots have a saying whenever they refer to a job that seems endless. They say, oh, like painting the Forth Bridge. It's a rail bridge that heads north out of Edinburgh across the mouth of the River Forth. It was built 120 years ago, and one reason it has stood that long is its design. From a distance, its two red spans rise gracefully above the water, but up close it's this complicated arrangement of girders and trusses and towers. It's a lot of steel, so much that when the painting crew finishes, they would routinely go back to the other end and start all over again. Well, that repetition came to an end this past December when the company responsible for the bridge decided to switch to a longer-lasting paint. Ian Heek is in charge of the Forth Bridge for Network Rail, and his job carries the weight of history. Construction on that bridge began in 1883, and it took 7 years to complete.
It was the biggest major steel structure in the world, this new material called steel. Before that, there was iron and wrought iron and so on, but this is the first major structure made out of steel. So it's been in existence since 1890, and seen two world wars and all the rest of it and all that goes with it.
And when I look at pictures of the bridge, Ian, I'm struck by how much metal there is there, how much steel. You know, you compare it to modern-day suspension bridges that have these high-tension cables that hold the roadbed off the water. But this, you know, if you're looking through the bridge, seems to be this sort of forest of girders.
It is to a certain extent. It's actually quite elegant when you go up high and look down. It's quite narrow and quite an elegant beastie. But, yeah, there's 53,000 tons of steel roughly on the bridge. So it's a chunky lady.
And my math, help me with this, has it as a little over 2.5 kilometres, which is like a mile and a half across the Firth.
Just under a mile and a half, between a mile and a quarter and a mile and a half. Yeah, a mile and a half is a good number, yep.
And was a pretty important change in the transportation when it was put in, I gather.
It was a total transformation. Basically, the trains went so far, stopped, you would get off onto a ferry, go across the river and re-embark. Now, that was for either train or road. So fundamentally, it was the first transportation link across the river and a very major link to the north, obviously. Because where we are is just about 10 miles or so from Edinburgh. And to the north of us are places like Dundee, which is a very industrial city. And then... Since then, of course, Aberdeen has just grown out of all proportion. So it's a very major link for all transportation in Scotland to the north.
Is it true what they say, that for years and years, for decades, the painting of the Forth Bridge has been a never-ending job?
There's certainly been presence on the bridge without question since the day it was built. And it was very much painted from one end to the other and then start again and start again. Yes, it was the colloquialism is true. Certainly in the early onset of the bridge, it was painted one end to the other and then start again.
And is that because it takes just so long to do that the paint at that point has worn off where you begun?
Well, when you paint something, there's something underneath wanting to get out in terms of potential rust and all that kind of stuff. And the very early paints were quite simple paints. They weren't such a good barrier to weather. So 3 or 4 years to paint the bridge, by that time, you're getting little bits of rust bursting through here and there. So to keep on top of it, you just keep going and round and round and round and round, just to try and keep a hold of any potential corrosion.
I would have thought after 80 or 90 years of continually repainting the bridge, there'd be so much paint on top of all the steel and the rivets that you would never be in any danger of rusting through.
Well, nice idea. Unfortunately, paint does kind of fail. Paint loses adhesion. Paint loses its effectiveness. So layer on layer is fine, but the very bottom layer is the one that really matters. If it's starting to fail off, and it does that by cracking and so on underneath and becoming very brittle, then weather gets through and can actually be busy doing things underneath the paint.
And so have you ever sat to try and figure out how many times that bridge has been repainted?
Oh, no, in a nutshell. I would say quite happily, 30 times maybe. wouldn't surprise me one bit if it was that sort of order, because it was about a 3-year rotation to paint from one end to the other. It would vary depending on the number of people, of course, working on it.
Yeah.
The lads would go to their job, just literally climb out on the bridge, walk out on the bridge and climb up the bridge and rub down areas that were needing cleaned off, rub down rusty areas and paint on top.
I can see that being pretty dangerous work, because so much of that, you'd be having to work upside down, right?
Very nearly upside down, aye. Particularly on suspended spans and areas like that, the underside of the bridge. Fundamentally, the lads worked off ropes of one sort or another. There weren't any harnesses way back then. They simply used ropes to get to and from places and then sit down or stand and paint away. But yeah, dangerous without question. It's dangerous enough today with all the safety measures we have today. Way back then, goodness me, that certainly would take a brave heart to go out there.
Have you ever spent time on the upper parts of the bridge, the place where you're looking down through the tracks at the water below?
Absolutely, no. A great deal of my time's on the bridge. That's the beauty of this job for Network Rail, meant and warranted me being here full time. And that let me get really pretty close, up close and intimate with the bridge and understand its problems. So the only way of doing that is out on the bridge. You must go onto the bridge to actually experience that top, bottom and middle. I've spent a lot of time out on the bridge over the last few years.
And silly question perhaps, but do you develop a kind of affection for the thing just because you're so busy with it all the time?
I'm smiling at that. Without question. It's a bridge that's famous throughout the world. My background is very much civil engineering. And for all I stay only, 20 minutes away, about 15 miles away from the bridge, I hadn't spent much time here as a boy, as a child or whatever. But when I got involved in this very first concept of being involved with the bridge, just absolutely meant so much more to me to think I was going to be part of it. It's the essence of engineering. So it'd be hard pushed to put to ask an engineer who doesn't say, yeah, that's a very, very special bridge. So you do have an effect for that, no question at all.
And Ian, were you a part of the team that sat down one day and said, look, we've really got to come up with a better paint so we don't have to keep painting the bridge?
Yes, in a nutshell. Very much so. There was an engineering need to go and take care of this bridge. We had to analyse the bridge. We could see what it was doing from an engineering point of view. And really, it was then a question of, right, how are we going to do it? And how do we protect that bridge? The most important thing was to get preparation correct, as ever. Preparation, 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 you end up with a good job. And then we looked at, well, what paint can we put on it?
Wait a second, let me interrupt you. When you talk about preparation, do you mean blasting all that old paint off, getting right back down to the original steel?
Yes, sir, every single square millimetre of it. Wow. And that's the first time it's ever been done in history, because the bridge has never been cleaned back to bare metal since it was built. So this is the first time in 120 years it's been done. But to get best adhesion for paint, to get best length of service in paint, you need a bright, clean, very clean surface to then apply that paint to. So we had to get the right preparation, so the decision was to make blast it off. We could not paint on top of paint, so we had to blast all the paint off, keep that blast nice and clean, and then apply new paint. What paint do we apply? We went to paint industry to see what their best of the best was and got recommendations from them. And back came what we are doing today, which is basically a three-coat system, or four-coat, if you count a thing called stripe coat, based on, well, loosely based on material that's been used in the North Sea oil for 25, 30 years. North Sea oil rigs are about as aggressive a place you can imagine for paint to stand up. So that has fed us very well in terms of material that we're using on the bridge.
It must have been something, though, to see that steel exposed and polished up shiny the way it would have looked to the engineers of the 1890s who built it.
It's one of the best parts about the bridge. I've got some quite nice before and after pictures right next to each other, you know, literally one side of a sheet and the other side of a sheet. And it looks pretty poor before, but when it's cleaned up, it's almost as good as the day it was built, or a lot of it was. Not all of it, but a lot of it is. And what you can see still on a lot of the paints are the what we call teep marks, or actual references on the plates, original references beaten in by hand to the plates, so as they're joined up in the right place on site. So they're all still evident in an awful lot of the bridge. So that is literally touching something that somebody has touched 120 years before. And that's a nice touch. That's a really nice touch back
then. Was there any thought given to coming up with a clear kind of epoxy paint so the bridge would sparkle like that?
No, sir. It's Fourth Bridge Red, and always will be Fourth Bridge Red. Thank you.
Fourth Bridge Red. It's actually a colour, is it?
It is. It's not a RAL. It's not a British standard. It's not an American standard. It's not an international standard colour. It's Fourth Bridge Red, which is a really nice touch. I'm sure you can copy it, no problem that way. But we do actually hold a paint, certainly from, maybe not from the very infancy of the bridge, but certainly very early in the age of the bridge. British Rail, as it was then, who ran the railways, basically hold a colour swatch that is matched for any time the bridge has been painted. They had to match the colour swatches that we hold in a lab down in England. But British Rail used to have a section called Derby Research, and in Derby they did all paint technology research, etc., over the years, and they held the colour, so that's still held on file.
Ian, when you were blasting all this paint off, how did you avoid all of it falling into the fourth, though?
Well, that's again, that comes back to the decision to really go at the bridge whole scale. When you blast, there's two things you really need to do. Preceding blast, you've got to create a very good access system. Scaffolding we've used pretty well throughout the bridge. So you erect a very good access system by scaffolding. That then needs to be fully encapsulated. We have on our bridge a lead base paint. Now, that lead base paint cannot be allowed to go to atmosphere. It cannot be allowed to go into the environment. So we need to encapsulate all the scaffolding totally to ensure everything that's blasted off is contained within the scaffolding. But that has a beautiful double edge to it, because it means you've got control of the environment inside to then apply that paint and keep control of it while it cures. So the encapsulation around the scaffolding literally keeps the rubbish in, keeps the debris in, lets you hoover that up, and then keep the weather out to let you apply and cure a paint, which is why I can see it will last 25, 30 plus years, because preparation has been good, and application and curing has been the best.
And so was this done section by section, Ian, or was there a point when the drapery was sort of lifted off the old lady in one grand sweep?
That's a lovely thought. No, it was very much section by section. But we had there's two things to think about. For all, it's a big, strong bridge, and she's super and all that kind of stuff. But if we had too much encapsulation up at the wrong place, you could actually affect the bridge. You know, you could actually make the part of the bridge fail if you have too much of a wind force on encapsulation. So we did have to kind of scatter it about, or it seemed to be scattered about. And we were often asked why we were going at it kind of haphazardly. We weren't. You know, it was a very measured scattering through the bridge to make sure the wind forces weren't too much for the foundations.
Listening to you talk about it, I'm wondering just how people in Edinburgh feel about the bridge. It sounds to me like people pay close attention to what happens to their rail
yes,
bridge.
Oh, yes, they do. The encapsulation was referenced as bandages. That's how it was kind of the layman looked at it. And a lot of people wanted these bandages red so it would kind of disappear a little bit. And you got a lot of comment back on, you know, why is it so white and why is it so obvious? Now, clearly for me, it's white to let the best amount of light in for the guys actually working inside. But the people outside don't see that. They just see a bridge that they like as red being white in encapsulation. So it's very closely monitored. And you see Edinburgh's just down the road. South Queens Ferry is the south end of the bridge, a very, very keen community there to keep me on my toes. North Queens Ferry, similarly. We know each other really well now. We know each other's needs, and we kind of take care of them if we can.
And you may have surmised that my last name, Gordon, connects me to mm-hmm. your neck of the woods, and yet I had, and while I inherited a lot of sayings, and I hadn't heard painting the fourth bridge. But tell me how that's used in regular conversation.
I think any job that seems to be taking forever, it's like painting the fourth bridge. I suppose if you're going for a long hike and it took forever and ever, or climbing a mountain that took ever and ever, it's like painting the fourth bridge. It has just got that colloquialism that it's something that takes forever. And once you've no sooner finished it, then you've got to start it again. Like painting your house, I suppose. not dissimilar. Doing the garden, doing the weeding. No sooner finishing up, they're popping again.
And so this new paint job, is it all finished now?
It is. That's as literally in December or so we put the last lick on of this sort of last 10-year phase. And looking really well. So we've got a wee time where we won't need to go at this bridge at all, anything like we've done before. And I'm of a mind we never ever will if we take care of the paint that's on there now. I think you're now in a second phase of taking care of the paint that's on there as we did when the bridge was first built. Because they put the best of stuff on in 1890. Lead-based paint's very good paint. It's very, very good at keeping weather out and so on and so forth. But it's softer than the new paints we've got now. So effectively, they were taking care of their original paint all the way through its history. I think we're almost at the same stage again. We've taken it back to bare metal. You've got the best preparation. You've got the best actual application of paint you could ask for. So I think we can now take care of that coat of paint rather than have to wait, go at it again in 20 years' time to blast it all off again. We can take care of it and get longer out of it.
You think people will stop talking about painting the fourth bridge as a never-ending task?
I kind of doubt it. I think it's kind of stuck with us. I think it's there. I think it's pretty well there forever. But it's nice that, in some ways, I hope they don't. You know, I'd hate to be the man who did away with that saying. that does leave me a little bit cold as a Scotsman. I think it's so well ingrained in people's minds that it will continue. I suspect it will continue.
Ian Heek is a project manager with Network Rail, and we have a link to a photo of that bridge on our website. It is something to see. Our website is thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
Support for the story comes from the Redwoods Group Foundation, collaborating with Darkness to Light and local YMCAs to prevent child sexual abuse in America. D2L.org.
The story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
And this is APM, American Public Media.